Cain and His Legacy, Commentary for the April 16, 2022 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord I have brought forth a man." Later she gave birth to his brother Abel. Genesis 4, verses 1 and 2. For every Jew born such, they consider themselves the children of Abraham. He is the great progenitor. Therefore, every part of Genesis seeks to answer three questions. Who is Abraham? Where did he come from? Why is he important? When the literalist reads this ancient narrative, they do so with an emphasis on the minute details of the story more than on the point. Abraham becomes lost in the details of, was creation 6 24-hour days? Are the two creation accounts in the first two chapters reconcilable? Were Adam and Eve real people or simply heroic metaphors? And what about Cain, Abel, and Seth? The various cultures of humanity all claim founding in heroic myths that resonate with the biblical narrative. We're not left clueless about this. One big clue is the names of the characters in Genesis. Prior to the sojourn in Egypt, a Hebrew character's name reflects his or her personality and role in the story. With the Exodus, that no longer seems to be significant beyond showing allegiance to deity. For instance, Adam means man, fitting for the first man. Similarly, Eve refers to her role as mother. Translated more accurately, they would simply be called first man and first mother, not proper names as we understand them, but descriptors. Who they were and whether they had proper names is less important than being foundations for the heroic narrative that allows Abraham to be traced back to God. Cain, Abel, and Seth are likewise descriptors. Cain, the man God gave me. Abel, the perished one. And Seth, the replacement. Abel gives us a larger clue than the rest. Why would someone be identified as a perished one at birth? If constructing a literal genealogy, this makes no sense. But if building a heroic narrative, it makes perfect sense and illustrates why Abraham has the struggles he does. There is a mighty battle being waged over eons involving the heavens and the earth. But before we look deeper at Abraham in later lessons this quarter, let us consider other clues. The fantastically long ages of the various characters is something we might expect in heroic legends. Without explanation, those ages rapidly decline in length after the flood account. It might be argued by apologists that this is because humanity began eating meat, as evidenced by the Noahic covenant. But that idea seems inconsistent with Abel offering a lamb from his flock in sacrifice. The author or authors of Genesis attempted to read back into the story of Noah the Levitical laws relating to animals who are unclean and those who are clean. If this is the case, why would the rules regarding how to do sacrifices also not apply, which required the one offering to eat a portion of the sacrifice? Likely, the fact that they were raising sheep and offering animal sacrifices indicates that meat eating was not novel after the flood. The covenant simply recognized that reality and was a facile transition from the apparent veganism of the creation account and the reality of the dietary practices of the author in his time. Another clue to the metaphorical aspects of the antediluvian story is the account about the sons of God and the daughters of men becoming intimate and having offspring. One possibility that apologists like to offer is that the sons of God are those descended from Seth, and the daughters of men are those descended from Cain. Literalism tends to walk us into such explanations that fall apart when they fail to explain what took place. It does not explain why the children of such unions would become legendary heroes. On the other hand, this would be understandable if the sons of God were angelic beings uniting with human beings and producing children. In the understanding of many cultures, such individuals would be demigods, like Hercules or Theseus. There may be a case for the panoply of the gods of polytheism being populated with angels cast to this earth and forced to eke out what they could in power and control over humanity, in the process becoming humanized themselves to the detriment of both. This could go a long way toward explaining how the various polytheistic cultures arose. Some would rebut this by stating that angels are incapable of having intimate relations at all, much less with humanity. There is no biblical basis for this belief, as the biblical canon is silent regarding sexual intimacy for angels. But understanding how the canon came about, we know those books that were silent on the matter were included, and those that spoke about it were excluded. Books like Enoch and the Book of Giants, books considered apocryphal by the post-Nicene Church. The Book of Enoch and the Book of Giants purport to recount antediluvian experiences. Therefore, if we examine the biblical account metaphorically, we may place these in that same metaphorical milieu. The Book of Giants fleshes things out further, indicating that the fallen angels engaged in bestiality with all of creation and produced horrendous monsters as a result. Those inclined to take such accounts literally will doubtless find justification for monsters such as antediluvian dinosaurs. This is something already claimed based on an obscure quote from Ellen White in Spiritual Gifts about miscegenation of man and beast. But the geological record with numerous recovered fossils tell us that by this point, literalism may be getting threadbare. However we want to populate the world prior to the flood, those details are only important to the literalist. Metaphorically, it's only important to understand that everything had gone seriously wrong like a flawed drawing on an etch-a-sketch. It might be easier to turn the whole thing upside down and begin again, hopefully with a better result. It may be easy to relegate this story to the mythical myths of an ancient past with little relevance for today, but it is a metaphor that has been lived out across many cultures, and therefore calls out a warning to the wary like blind Tiresias. As we look around us today, we see much to be concerned about, and that warning rings ever louder in our ears. The power of metaphor is in its applicability across cultures and time. Every time we read of the fall of Jerusalem, we see the potential collapse of our own societies. We see in every brutal act perpetrated by one against another echoes of the destruction of Abel by his brother. We see in the immorality and heartlessness that surrounds us the ruthlessly evil imaginations and acts of those in the antediluvian world, and we shudder. But the point of the metaphor is not to leave us in hopeless dread, demanding, why doesn't God fix things? Is he indifferent to suffering? Is he powerless to intervene? But as the story continues, we discover that God does intervene in suffering. But how does that explain the ongoing suffering we all experience? If he put an end to their suffering, why doesn't he do so now? As Christians, we struggle with this more than we should. Buddhists see suffering as a part of the path to enlightenment. If so, it is a hard lesson to learn as we keep on stumbling along the way. For instance, one would think after God dealt with evil in the antediluvian world, humanity would do better. But problems began almost immediately after. Sadly, we have no problem inflicting suffering on others to teach them a lesson. But when we suffer, we do not see it as a lesson. Rather than learn from it, we lay the responsibility on God and blame his indifference, impotence, or even his existence. As we go through Genesis this quarter, we can search for the most righteous character in the book other than God. When we pick out who we think meets that definition, we can ask ourselves whether their character is a result of the role of suffering in their life, and whether it invalidates or substantiates their faith in God. Then, once we have done that, we can ask how their experience compares to ours. Great literature uses metaphor to bring us to a deeper understanding of ourselves and whom we aspire to be. The Bible does that in spades. Many years ago, I bought a dot matrix printer that I planned to print out Bible quizzes on. It seemed simple enough to set up, but try as I might, I could not get the computer to communicate with the printer. The printer cable was attached to the parallel port, and the printer was turned on, but I kept getting the message, printer not found. But it was right there, plugged into the correct port. Seeing my frustration, my wife asked, did you read the manual? Like others, I had assumed I could do such a simple task and had discarded the manual with the packing materials. Retrieving it, I walked through the steps it gave, and everything was soon working properly. Sometimes God is like my wife was. When struggling with a problem of suffering and getting frustrated with it, he asks me, did you read the manual? Thank you for listening to this podcast. You can find the written copy of this podcast, as well as many other commentaries and podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.